Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Seems like you guys really want to know about my debates. It was one of the questions brought up a lot during our 100th anniversary episode. And it's something people bring up a lot, and I enjoy that because honestly, when I rank the different things I do as a Catholic apologist, my favorite thing to do is to get into the ring, get into the academic, theological ring, if you will, and engage in a debate with someone who disagrees with the Catholic faith in a formal, moderated public debate. I find them to be intellectually invigorating. They're fun, and I think that they're a tremendous service to other people for them to be able to see the reasonableness of our faith. One, that it can stand up to criticism, and two, that it can expose flaws in other people's worldviews or ways of thinking. So that's why I wanted to share with you a recent interview I did on the Classical Theism podcast. ClassicalTheism.com is hosted by John DeRosa. Its goal is to defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation. It's a wonderful podcast. I definitely recommend you check it out. This episode will be going up probably in a few weeks, but you get a sneak peek here on the Council of Trent podcast because you are my friends, my faithful listeners, and your support makes the podcast possible. So if you visit classicaltheism.com, don't forget to also visit trenthornpodcast.com as well to keep this podcast going and to access to all kinds of great little goodies. And now, without further ado, my interview with John DeRosa on how to defend the Catholic faith in debates.
We're joined by Trent Horn, staff apologist at Catholic Answers, adjunct professor at Holy Apostles College and Seminary, and the author of 5 books, including his most recent book, Made This Way, co-authored with Layla Miller. Trent Horn, welcome back to the Classical Theism Podcast.
Thanks for having me back, John.
Trent, last time you were with us, you mentioned you're writing a new book on Jesus. Can you remind us what that's about and when it might be available?
Sure. The book is called Counterfeit Christs, and it's about the false, incorrect views that people have about Jesus. This includes non-religious people who think he's kind of a non-judgmental preacher, or someone who's a legend that we don't know very much about, atheists who think Jesus never existed, world religions like the Muslim view of Jesus as a prophet or the Eastern view of Jesus as a guru, also includes what I call quasi-Christianity. So the Mormon and Jehovah's Witness views of Jesus as being not being fully divine, like we believe God the Father is fully divine. And also the way ideologues hijack Jesus' teaching, such as the so-called gay-affirming Jesus or the Jesus who teaches the prosperity gospel. And finally, even some incorrect views of Jesus that some Protestants have. So all of it together in one treatment, I think it'll be very helpful for people.
Excellent. Sounds very comprehensive. Any thoughts on when it might be available?
Probably late spring, so May, June, I'm hoping. So yeah, hopefully it'll be a late spring release.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to getting the book and reading about it. But today we're discussing a different topic. We're talking about the what's, whys, and hows of defending Catholic ideas in debates. Now, our focus here at the Classical Theism Podcast is equipping Catholics to defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation. And you do a lot of that as well. But a subset of those folks might be interested in defending ideas in debates one day, or just want to learn more about it. What are some things that make debates different than everyday conversations?
Well, the biggest thing that makes a debate different than a conversation is that there is an audience. There are people who are observing this interaction. And your goal in a debate is not so much to convince the other person of your position, because they're probably very trenchant. They're ensconced into the position they're defending. Your goal is to represent the truth, the position you want to defend, and encourage others who are observing what you're debating about, especially those who are on the fence, to be able to come over to your side. So it's interesting, when I do Catholic Answers Live, it's sort of a hybrid between a debate and a conversation, because I'm having conversations with people on the radio, but we both know there are possibly hundreds of thousands of people listening to us as we're having this conversation. So it turns it into more of a, and it's, now some of these conversations stay conversational and are quite pleasant. Other people kind of take note of that, and it becomes more debatey. Another good adjective to describe debates versus conversations is that they're adversarial. And it's not necessarily in a bad light. I don't hate the people that I debate against. I think that they're mistaken. I would very much like for them to convert and give up their mistaken position that they have. But we're intellectual adversaries, so we're engaged in a kind of intellectual boxing match that you don't have in more of a friendly, good-natured conversation. So yeah, when you do a debate, there's three kinds of people who are going to be listening. There's the people who are going to stick up for you no matter what. They're the people who are going to stick up for the other guy no matter what. And then the people in the middle. The people in the middle are always the ones that I'm trying to reach the most.
Very good. Well, that's an interesting point about Catholic Answers Live, because now that I think about it, some callers want to just have a back and forth, like conversational in tone. But other callers, you can tell they kind of like want to grandstand and get their points in for the larger audience. So that's interesting that you point that out. But you've done several debates on a bunch of topics: abortion, God's existence, and you spoke about how some of your goals are to move the middle. Can you speak a little bit more about some of your goals in these debates and maybe how you define success in a debate?
Sure. I would say that success in a debate would come about that I've put forward a clearly exposed and outlined argument, a clearly articulated argument that has concrete points and evidences. So my argument was communicated clearly. I was able to answer objections to my arguments that I'm presenting, and I was able to mount rebuttals or replies to the argument of my opponent. So there's different elements involved. First, there's building up your case, defending your case against attacks. And then there is critiquing and launching objections against your opponent's case, and then answering the replies of your opponent. So I would say that debates usually I've never actually had formal debate training. I was never in the debate club in high school. And debate, like in high school forensics or college forensics, it's really more of a technical enterprise. So you're judged on, if you look at high school debate competitions, these guys speak a mile a minute to try to cram in as many arguments and evidences as they can for judges that are scoring them in a technical way. I don't debate that way because I'm debating for the average person. So for me, success is that when my opponent will put forward, let's say he's got five arguments that he's making, but by the very end of the debate, he's only making one argument because he has nothing else to offer to defend the other four. I would call that a success if I can say, here are my five arguments, here are the replies to the objections my opponent made to them, and notice he's dropped all his arguments, he's only got one left, but here's still what's wrong with it. So in debate parlance or lingo, that's called a drop. So if your opponent makes an argument, you reply, you give a rebuttal to it, and they don't say anything more, you kind of won that point. So the key there is, in technical terms, is to get your opponent to drop as many arguments as the debate continues. And once again, I'm not trying to win in a technical way. I'm trying to show the audience that the position I'm defending is true, so it can stand up to attacks, and the position my opponent has articulated is false, and it simply cannot stand up to scrutiny, and so they ought not believe in it.
Well, very good. Those are some awesome general principles of what to go for in a debate and what it looks like. You want to be clear, you want to answer the objections, and then mount your own successful objections. Perhaps you can give us now an inside look into something more concrete, into how you prepared for your recent debate with Dan Barker. What goes into debate preparation, and what are the important things that you do?
Sure. When it comes to preparing for a debate, it really varies based on the opponent. So sometimes I've had debates against an opponent I've never heard of before. I've done some pro-life debates against people I didn't know who they were. They had never written anything on abortion. So you kind of go in a little bit blind and you just kind of prepare for some more of the general arguments that are made. And you just have prepared rebuttals for the most common arguments that are made. And then you have stuff in your head you can think of off on the fly if they bring up something that's a bit more novel. For someone like Dan, there's an advantage that we were debating whether the Christian God exists, and so I was able to peruse Dan's books. I've already written on Dan's arguments before, like in my book Hard Sayings, so I went back to his book Godless, for example, that he published many years ago, actually. I think it was first called Losing Faith and Faith, and then he re-released it as Godless. So articles he'd written on the internet, and more importantly, for people who debate a lot, watching previous debates. So what was funny with Dan is I went back to Godless, and I looked at some of his debates, and I had prepared my material and replies for him. But then I decided to to look at his more recent book. Like a year ago, he wrote a book called God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction. And then I looked at debates he had done like in the past 12 months, and I saw that his strategy and arguments had changed a little bit. So it was helpful for me to say, oh, so this is what he's using now. So I know what he's going to do so I can adequately prepare for it. And that's the essence of debates. To do well in debates is simply to be prepared. The more work you can have done before you walk into the debate, the better off you're going to be. That means having an opening statement that is prepared, written out. If you notice in the Barker debate, in fact, I had a reviewer of our debate marveled at this, that I finished 1 second before the buzzer went off.
That's unbelievable.
I practice my opening statements and I leave myself about 20 seconds of wiggle room, knowing that I might speak slower in a real environment or something will go wrong. So I practice and I trim the fat on my opening statements. I've seen debaters just pontificate. They'll waste 3 minutes telling their life story and you're losing time to put forward arguments. You should pack that opening statement with good arguments and with evidences, positive evidence for your position. And then, though, to be really prepared is to make sure, okay, what's the other guy going to say? Then to have your rebuttals planned out, to have quick, ready replies. The biggest rule for debates is this. Whenever you speak off the top of your head, it's going to be worse than if you prepared. Everyone does that. Everyone's the same way. The more you can have prepared, but also still have that flexibility to go with the flow because you don't know what's going to happen, the better off you're going to be.
That's a great tip, Trent, and I totally agree with that. When I try to speak off the top of my head, it never comes out as well in any setting. If I'm teaching the class, or just having a conversation, or at a department meeting, or something with my colleagues. But Trent, it sounds like debates are a lot of work from what you're describing. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of information out there on books and the internet, and how do you decide what arguments to include? And do you have any way of, you know, field testing them with colleagues or on the internet or on the radio? Maybe you can even speak again to the Barker debates to give us some specific insights of how you decide what to include and whether you do any field tests. Let us know about that.
Sure. And that is why I don't do debates. It's not like I do a debate every month. Debates are very time intensive, especially depending on my opponent. So it's, in some cases, if it's abortion and the person doesn't know what they're talking about, I know it's not going to be that difficult. But in other cases, it's like someone like Dan Barker. I mean, I don't think intellectually he has the best arguments, but he's good at rhetoric because he's done over 100 debates. So he's comfortable on stage with little debate quips. And you have to be prepared for that. Honestly, the toughest people to debate, if someone said to me, who would you have the toughest time debating against? It would not be a world-class philosopher. It would probably be a comedian. Someone like Ricky Gervais would honestly be a comedian would be the hardest person for you to debate than a philosopher, because they're very good to be quick on their feet and they're witty. If somebody can get a good joke in a debate that lands well, they're almost halfway to winning the debate because the audience is on their side. And so when you do debates, you have to practice and be prepared for that. So you need to be prepared, but you can't be stiff. You can't be a robot who's stuck to your notes when you're in prep mode. You got to have the tools in your toolbox, but you also have the experience to use them in unusual or unorthodox ways, or ways your opponent won't necessarily see coming. So yeah, when it comes, you're right. You can't know everything before you go into a debate. The best you can do is pick a limited set of arguments that goes towards your position. And you really have to pick them based on the resolution of the debate. So, you know, with Dan, it was, does the Christian God exist? So that means I'm definitely including the resurrection of Jesus or the deity of Christ. And then knowing, though, that, you know, Dan's objections to that will come from the atheist sphere. He's not going to argue against the deity of Christ like a Jehovah's Witness would, but he will, like, it, you know, as an atheist does. So knowing where your opponent's going to go and just having, especially knowing their previous written or spoken work, gives you a leg up in your prep time.
And now, do you do any field testing of arguments? Do you have read your opening statement? Do you use them on the radio? I'm just curious of like that little process too. Give us some insights.
The field testing, a lot of it is I just try to sit down and see if I could, you know, I'll write them out. And I've tried this. This is something very important to do in your own life as an apologist or defender of the faith. When you put forward an argument, you should try to sit down and say, all right, if I was the other guy, how would I refute this? A lot of people just aren't good at that. They'll put down an argument and say, this is great. No one could refute this. But I try to sit down and say, well, how could I take this apart? And trying to get in the other person's head. So usually I field test them against myself. And then other times, it depends on the different fields, I might try to call an expert in to see if I'm on track. So if it's an argument over a particular Greek term, I might send an email out to a colleague or a friend who has extensive training in Koine Greek. If it's philosophy, maybe I'll shoot an email out to Ed Fazer or to a philosopher and say, hey, I want to make sure this argument is sound. So sometimes I'll do that, but usually 80% of the time, I just sit in my intellectual, my lab, the writer's lab, and just try to take them apart myself.
Well, I have to say, Trent, you've given us some great practical tips already. One, anything prepared is going to be better than when we're speaking off the cuff. And two, that when we're coming up with an argument, we have to ask ourselves, what would the other guy say to this and how would I respond? I completely agree. Like, it's easier just to come up with something and just say it right away. But those are two great
practical
tips we can use when preparing for a debate. I got some more questions, though, for you. Now, the opening statement can be really prepared. So that we might even be able to sit down and do. But what are the most difficult parts of a debate, and how can one prepare for those? Maybe you can even give us some specifics, again, about the recent debate with Dan. What are some of the most difficult parts in a debate?
Yeah, the most difficult parts in a debate are the parts that are unscripted and you're not sure what's going to happen. So the toughest part is probably cross-examination followed up by the rebuttals. So cross-examination is difficult because not all debates include cross-examination. I like including it because I think it's the most exciting part of the debate and people enjoy seeing the debaters go back and forth. What makes it difficult is you don't know what the other person is going to ask. And I had a general idea of where Dan would go, but I still wanted to wait to see that. And your opponent's going to ask you a bunch of trap questions. And so, you have to be prepared to answer simply and clearly and with a bit of humor. So I remember, I think Dan asked me a question like, does God always answer prayers? Do you believe God always answers prayers? And so I know where he's going. He's going to try to say that unanswered prayers show that God does not exist. And so I instead of fumbling around saying, well, he does answer prayers, but Dan, you're going to say this, or yeah, instead of a bunch of qualifications, I simply said, yes, just sometimes he always answers prayers. Sometimes he says no. And I just leave it one sentence and people laughed, and that successfully neuters his counter reply. I mean, he still goes in that way, but I set the deck. So as I said before, the toughest people to debate are not philosophers, they're comedians. Part of debate is knowing your argument, but even more importantly is being able to communicate it in a pithy, almost entertaining way for people to latch on to. There's a book that was written a while ago, I forget the author, it was called Made to Stick. And it's the idea of why certain ideas resonate with people and others don't. So we have to kind of make our ideas and replies kind of stick. So cross is hard that they'll ask you questions you're not sure of how to answer, but you got to answer them clearly and quickly and maintain control of the environment. Then when you ask questions in cross, you have to maintain control. I always say the moderator, tell the audience I'm allowed to interrupt the other guy. Because a lot of times I'll ask a question to my opponent and he'll try to talk his way out of it for 3 minutes, waste half the time because he doesn't know how to answer. And he could do that, but that I say, no, let's move on. Or no, answer this. That way, because I want to show that his answer to the position doesn't make sense. Another good rule in cross-examination is this. It's the old lawyer's rule. And this is something, as I've grown in debates, this is an area I still have to grow in and have been growing in. Only ask a question you know the answer to. So when you ask your opponent a question, ask a question that has a specific answer to it. Like, where in the Bible does it say X? Or I think in the debate with Dan, I said, where does the Catholic Church teach that its clerics will be free from grave sin? Because he brought up the scandal. He said, it doesn't teach that. I said, okay, exactly. I didn't ask him an open-ended question because you don't want to give your opponent an open-ended question because he can play around all day with it. Give him something narrow that you know the answer to.
Wow, Trent, I am gaining a whole new appreciation for this. This stuff is hard. And the tips you're giving and the stuff that's going
yes,
through your head,
is.
I mean, this is difficult.
I've been up there. I remember, I think my wife watched during the James White debate. Some of our friends came over and watched on the big screen with my wife. And I think one of them said, why did Trent say that? He should have said this instead. And Laura's like, it looks easy, but when you're up there, it feels like the time is racing by 10 times as fast. it's something different. It's different when you're out there, and you really have to learn it through a lot of trial and error. And I've had my fair share of trials and errors to learn, you know, and still learn in the art of debate.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you sharing the art of debate with the listeners. And I will say, no, I am not going to be an armchair debate critic. Hearing all this that goes into it and just imagining myself on that stage, it sounds like a very difficult job, but you do it with grace and precision, and you really do a nice job of defending Catholic ideas, and I thank you for that.
Thank you. Oh, I wanted to add also with Cross, right after, though, the second most difficult thing are rebuttals, and the biggest thing here is keeping track in your mind of the arguments the other guy made and the rebuttals he made to you, and being able to answer all of them. My most successful debates, including the ones against Barker and White, people notice it's successful when I can say, here's every argument they made, here's what's wrong with it, here are all their rebuttals, here's what's wrong with them. William Lane Craig, for example, is an amazing debater. What makes him an amazing debater is he can keep track of every single argument in the debate and make a reply to it. Poor debaters, they'll kind of talk about the issue and about what their opponent said in general, but don't make specific replies. So it feels like they keep falling behind. Then there are arguments they never got around to answering.
That's a great point. You do make a lot of specific replies. I can just remember, this is inside baseball now, but off the top of my head, in your debate with James White, he has made the argument consistently for probably a couple decades. He's talked about when people raise certain scriptures, you know, if this, then that. He said there's the prescriptive way and there's the descriptive way. And he always makes right. that point. And I really never thought his opponents challenged him on it, but you finally did in your rebuttal. You said he didn't really give us any rule for deciding whether things are prescriptive or descriptive. It's just whether it agrees with like some other points he made. And I thought that was a very good point that not a lot of Catholics have made over the years. So nice work.
Yeah, when you're in a debate, you have to be careful. Don't chase the rabbit trails. Your opponent might throw, and like James did that in our debate, you know, the Assumption of Mary or anti-Semitic popes. That's not the content of the debate. And so if you chase a rabbit trail, you lose the main things you're supposed to be debating, and you want to challenge the foundational issues of your opponent's position.
Now, there's many debates on YouTube available, Trent, of course, as you know. Who are some Catholics or even some non-Catholic Christians that you admire when it comes to debates? Who would you recommend we listen to in order to learn sure. more debating skills and arguments?
Yeah, well, don't listen to me. I'm still growing in this area. If I look back on it in 20 years, I'll be like, oh, that was my rookie phase. But I still think William Lane Craig is probably the best debater out there. I mean, I don't agree with all of his theology and philosophy, but he's excellent when it comes to the form of debate. He can be a little stiff sometimes. So I think like when I try to do debates, I try to have a little bit of fun with it. And that's important for the audience to kind of relate to you. Likeability, I think, is important for debates. But Craig is very polished. So he's a good example of being prepared when you do debates. Also, another good person who's good to check for debates, there's a Catholic debater in England with Catholic Voices. His name's Peter D. Williams, and he's debated White several times. I think he has a very good handle on the argument, so I would definitely recommend him. Let's see. Oh, Jimmy does not do debates as much anymore because they are so time consuming. But back in the day, there's some, you know, the Bible Answer Man debate. Jimmy has done a few debates, and he's just great at being very thorough and methodical. So seeing a few of the debates that he's done, I think, is very helpful. And there's a few atheist debaters who I think are very good. I think Richard Carrier, ever since he debated William Lane Craig in 2009, and I think Craig did very well in that debate compared to Carrier, Carrier kind of upped his game in the debating school. And so when I see people debate him, Carrier is very good at being extremely prepared and you know, being prepared for every reply his opponent might make. And that's why my debate with him on the historicity of Jesus, I thought, was a very good debate. And he, you know, he's very knowledgeable and brought a lot to that as well. So I had to bring a lot to, and a lot of people said they'd never seen a Christian be able to stand toe to toe with Carrier like we did in our debate a few years ago. So, yeah, so you want to keep advantage and keep track of both Christians and Catholics who are good at this, as well as atheists. And oh, there's one other guy. I'm going to look him up. He writes for Secular Outpost, and he wrote a book on like Swinburne arguments. Oh, he debated Craig at some point. When the name comes to me, I'll bring it back up. But he's another good one. So it'll come to me in a second. In like 2 minutes, I'll say, oh, it was that guy.
But, well, feel free to tell us. Yeah, but I got to disagree with one of those, Trent. I just don't agree at all. The audience needs to listen to you. Okay, I know you're a very humble guy, but they need to listen to you in debates and listen to you on the radio because you have a lot of great stuff to say. But I got a couple more questions for you here. We've talked a lot about the positives and the preparation behind debates. What are some downsides of debates? You know, if there are any, what are some negatives?
Sure. Keith Parsons. I didn't even have to Google
it. Oh, Keith Parsons. Yeah, he debated Craig and all these guys. He has a written debate with Fazer. Great stuff.
Yeah, Parsons is very good. He combines a good philosopher with kind of a preacher a little bit. So Parsons is actually, you should take some lessons from him how he does debates. Didn't have to Google it. It came to me there. He blogs at Secular Outpost a little bit. So the downsides of a debate. Well, here are the downsides. Debates are not a great way to analyze an issue in depth and to look at all the different nuances. Debate is a sport. I know some people will say, why even bother doing debates? I mean, it really doesn't tell you whether the position is true or not. I mean, I have seen Catholics get walloped in debates. It doesn't mean Catholicism is not true. It just means they weren't having a good day or they're not up for debating. So why do debates at all? What's the point of them? Because I believe you could do books and journal replies is better at getting to the truth. I think debates serve a good purpose in that they're entertaining and they get people interested in the subject being debated. I think they serve that purpose very well. So if you have someone who is nominally interested in apologetics, the existence of God, whether they're an atheist or a Christian, or whether they're Catholic or Protestant, if they're interested in debating these ideas about whether they're true or false and competing ideas, a debate is a good way to introduce these people who are kind of in the shallow end of the swimming pool, still trying to understand the different positions. And so I think they serve in that way. Like when I'll go to universities, if I go to a university and I give a talk on the existence of God, maybe 20 people will show up. When I did my debate against Barker at the Minnesota State University, 350, 400 people filled the auditorium and another 150 went to a overflow room. People like the sport. They like seeing both sides being presented equally. So I think they are good in getting people excited about an issue and, you know, want to come out for fight night and to get to prime and generate their interest in learning more about the subject. They're bad if you treat them as the final end of determining truth. Debates are not the end. They're an invitation to explore a subject more. The only one thing better than an oral debate would be like a book debate. There are some books that are structured where two authors submit opening chapter, opening arguments, and then the remaining chapters are replies to one another. These tend to be more thought out and better written, so those can actually help you really understand an issue well. There was one, I think, Alvin Plantinga and Michael Tooley did one. Yes. On the existence of God. J.J. Smart and John Haldane did another good book like that as well. Those kind of books actually are debate books. Can help you learn about an issue very well, including the Zondervan series. Zondervan has like 35 books on all kinds of topics Protestants and even Catholics debate, like four views on X. Those can be good to see a wide variety of views because you all see the authors interact with each other.
Very good. Well, to finish up, Trent, I wanted to ask, do you have any debates on the schedule for 2019? And what are some topics you'd like to debate in the future if the right situation comes along?
Sure. I apologize. That was a verbal munchie there. I should not start a reply with sure or or ah or but.
Oh, that's fine.
There it is. You, in order to do this kind of work, you have to be critical of yourself. You always have to strive for excellence and see where you are falling short and where you can always grow in different areas. When it comes to debates in the future, I don't have any on the calendar now. I don't actually seek out debates. I might change that in the future because I see them as being a valuable teaching tool. So I might start taking the initiative to start planning more debates in the future. But the only one that's kind of on the radar now, maybe next fall, I might debate some Catholics on the question of whether you can believe in the theory of evolution. Well, I think actually our debate will be on whether the Earth is 10,000 years old or not. So this is not a common view among Catholics. You find it way more among Protestants, evangelicals, but Catholics who believe in young Earth creationism, we're in dialogue about setting up a debate on whether evolution is true. Well, really more whether the Bible and science tell us that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. I think that'll be fun. So that's in the planning stages. We'll see if it comes to fruition. But otherwise, I'm open to other debates in the future. And I'd love to debate. I'd love to continue to debate atheism. To debate other moral issues might be fun. I might also enjoy even debating certain specific doctrines, like whether hell is eternal, whether God has knowledge of the future, like open theism. So sky's the limit, really.
Well, Trent Oren, thanks again for joining us on the Classical Theism Podcast. You're a role model to all of us who want to defend Catholic Christian ideas in conversation. Please let the listeners know where they can go to find out more about your work, and then we'll say goodbye.
Sure, I'd recommend that they check out TrentHornPodcast.com. I do a daily podcast called The Council of Trent, and you can learn all kinds of tips and knowledge and skills to be able to explain and defend your Catholic faith. That is available at TrentHornPodcast.com.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.